Dave Forman is regarded as one of America's foremost grassroots environmental activists.
It was a very volatile time for him developing his ideas and all. You know, he killed the green firewolf in 1909, but it didn't have an immediate effect. 10 years later, he started what became the New Mexico Wildlife Federation, the New Mexico Game Protection Association, and they had a newsletter called the Pine Cone, and it was beating the drum for wiping out all wolves and mountain lions and other predators. And then the real turnaround came in the late 20s after the Park Service had killed off every wolf in the national parks in the lower 48 states, even in Yellowstone, taken out all the mountain lions. I mean, Yellowstone National Park was so hard, they were even had rangers out crushing pelican eggs because the pelicans were predating on the brown trout that was being put in for fishermen. And they were trapping out river otters because they ate the fish. They were just going after everything in the parks, getting rid of the bad animals for the good animals. And then they proposed to wipe out the wolves in Mount McKinley National Park in Alaska, which is now Denali, to increase the population of Dall sheep. Well, Olas and Abe Murray, who had done field research up there, got involved trying to stop that. The American Society of Mammalogists came on board. Even the Ecological Society of America and even the Boone and Crockett Club, you know, that Teddy Roosevelt started as a quality hunters group, all against the wiping out of predators in the national parks, particularly in Mount McKinley. And Leopold came on to that too, but I think it was his relationship with the Murrays and with other people there in the late 20s that really caused him to reflect back on his experience in the Southwest. It's really interesting to trace how he overcame these old prejudices, but it was the experience in the Southwest particularly that did that. And then as far as watershed goes, when he went down to Mexico and to the Sierra Madre in 36, and wrote later that it was the first time he had ever seen a healthy watershed because the Apaches had kept settlement out. So there had been no cows, there had been no predator control, there had been no fire control. And he said that then the Gavilan, for the first time, he saw a healthy stream and realized that everything he had seen in similar country in New Mexico and Arizona for the previous nearly 30 years had been unhealthy. And then he went to Germany to look at forest and saw how it was just, you know, plantation forestry. The foresters picked up all the branches that fell off and it was just clean. And those kind of experiences together at the sort of the same year, I think really got him thinking even more about his experience in the Southwest.
Again, Susan Flauder.
During that time, he was invited to give the John Wesley Powell Address to the Southwestern Division of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, and he took as his title the Conservation Ethic. That was the first published version of what would later, after several other principal addresses over the years, be combined in his seminal article, The Land Ethic, which is the capstone of a Sand County Almanac. And in reviewing those several essays, it has seemed to me that his concept of a land ethic grew very much out of his concern for southwestern watersheds and the problem of soil erosion.
Again, Courtney White.
And so that's how the whole idea of land health then comes to him. And it really comes to home to him in 1936 when he goes to the Gavilan in Mexico. And he sees a landscape that was largely untouched by people because it's still coming out of the Apache period. And so it's not been settled. So he goes on a hunting trip and he sees what he calls a healthy landscape. And he didn't realize that up until that point, he'd be truly looking at unhealthy land. And so this really sets him thinking about land and land health and land use. And then the next step is, how do you start to correct it, to prevent it? What incentives, what policies, what programs, what laws are needed to get folks, public or private landowners, to conserve these resources? Because what he saw was that once it starts to degrade, it's almost too late at that point. This is why conservation is the motivating force for him. You want to conserve these resources before they start to degrade.
He thought hard, and he had an incredibly open mind. All his life, he was characterized by an open, questioning mind. He had three experiences that really were transformational for him. He acquired the shack, the land along the Wisconsin River that was exhausted, burned over, and abandoned by its previous owners. And Leopold and his family began working to restore that environment, to rebuild that community.
And again, Estella Leopold.
It's very open wasteland, really. The farmer had gone broke, putting in corn after corn, and left for taxes. And Dad got it for $8 an acre. So we got there, and Mother looked around and said, "Aldo, are you sure you want to bring the children up here?" And Dad said something like, "Yeah, you know, we're going to plant all this stuff. Put pinery up there on the ridge and put prairie out on the cornfield, and won't that be wonderful?" And it was. It was great. So we began work on the shack, and it became our home away from home. And it was no utilities, just a pump, and the Parthenon, the privy down the way on the edge of the terrace. And we were there every weekend, all the way through the 30s and the 40s, just about every weekend, and absolutely loved it. We built the fireplace, and we fixed the roof, and we put in windows and screens, and finally put in a floor, because we had a clay floor at first. Mother said we had to fix that, so we did. And we had bunks. We had a great time up there. And we were doing restoration ecology, which was the beginning of restoration ecology. Yeah, we put prairie plants into the cornfield, and after a while there was enough weeds and these plants that we could burn it off. And Dad, we set fire to it, and right away the grasses began to expand, because as the flames would come upwind, the grass would drop over behind the flames and drop the seeds on the fertilized ash and, you know, produce new plants. And pretty soon it became a tall grass prairie. It was wonderful. And then we began adding flowering plants to that prairie.
Actually, before he had much chance to do very much at the shack, he was invited on a trip to Germany, to the land of his ancestors, where he would study forestry and game management, as they had been practiced for centuries by the Germans. And when he got there, he was dismayed to find a completely artificialized environment. Deer that were being fed on crops that were grown outside of the forest, because there weren't sufficient understory plants for the deer to forage on in the forest. The trees had to be bundled, protected with twigs and branches tied around their trunks, because the deer would otherwise try to seek nutrients by stripping the bark from the trees. A very artificialized system. And Leopold came home. He wrote a number of articles on Germany, deer and Dauerwald in Germany. And when he got home, wrote an article on threatened species, in which he made the case that we had to protect the diversity of wildlife that we still had in our country, but that Germany had lost. That was the first time that he actually made the pitch publicly for protecting wolves and grizzly bears and other species that he had once sought to exterminate from the Southwest. He also had a trip very shortly after that to Mexico, to the Sierra Madre, along the Rio Gavilan in northern Mexico, just south of the New Mexico-Arizona border. He was going to go deer hunting with bow and arrow, his new hobby. And he was so taken with that country along the Rio Gavilan, he realized that here there were still wolves and mountain lions, and they didn't seem to be interfering with the deer populations. There were still plenty of deer. Fires still passed regularly over the land, whether set by lightning or possibly by Indians. And fires didn't seem to hurt the environment. The streams were still running between mossy banks, their waters clear without a lot of gravel in the watercourse. This was a land that still had, as he put it, its perfect aboriginal health. That concept of land health was a new concept for Leopold, and it gave him a sense that the goals of what he had been doing all his life of land management actually now had the goal not simply to produce more deer or pines for harvest, but to produce a healthy ecosystem. And that juxtaposition of experiences at the shack in Germany and in Mexico along the Rio Gavilan was very transformational to him.
Gary Paul Nabhan is a well-known ethnobotanist and author who has long recognized the importance of understanding the relation of indigenous culture to respective habitat.
You know, I've been meditating on Aldo Leopold's second trip in the Rio Gavilan in the Chihuahuan borderlands that he took with his brother Carl and his son Starker and a number of friends from both New Mexico and Chihuahua. And it was ostensibly a hunting trip, but what he harvested there was far more than venison or quail or bear meat. What he found there was the concept of ecosystem health that we now use. He called it ecological health. And that concept included rather than excluded land-based cultures. And after living in New Mexico with the Luna family, after growing up in Iowa among many land-based ethnic cultures, he had this in his background that stewardship of the land, whether it's done by hunters and gatherers or whether it's done by farmers and ranchers, can stabilize, enhance, or restore the diversity of depleted places and does not inextricably mean that humans will deplete that diversity. Where he discovered this was on the terraces of the Rio Gavilan in the headwaters of that watershed in 1937, where he realized that he was not in a fully natural, quote-unquote, landscape, but that prehistoric peoples had made rock terraces, what we call trincheras today, and that those had kept the watershed there intact to the point that centuries after those trincheras were constructed by people using dry-laid stone, deer were laying in the waist-high grasses on those terraces, eating the mast of acorns that had been maintained by the productivity, the soil renewal that happens when water cascades down through a terraced watershed. Now, the curious thing was that he talked about the Rio Gavilan as both a watershed and a food shed. And our notion of a food shed wasn't in common currency in 1937. When he was there, we're talking about something 80 years later that term has reached perhaps its greatest expression of what needs to be done to bring people back into the restoration of food-producing landscapes. Yet he talked about the food that he was eating in the Rio Gavilan as inextricably related to the health and wealth of that wild and cultural landscape. And I want to read you just a couple quotations that I think gets to this whole thing. He wrote, "Every region has a human food symbolic of its fatness, the land's fatness he's talking about. The hills of the Gavilan find their gastronomic epitome in this wise. Kill a mass-fed buck, not earlier than November, no later than January. Hang him in a live oak tree for 7 frosts and 7 suns. Then cut the half-frozen straps from their bed of tallow under the saddle and slice them transversely into steaks. Rub each steak with salt, pepper, and a little flour. Throw into a Dutch oven containing deep smoking hot bear fat and standing on live oak coals. Fish out the steaks at the first sign of browning. Throw a little flour into the fat, then ice cold water, then milk. Lay a steak on the summit of a steaming sourdough biscuit and drown both in gravy. Now the structure here is symbolic, Leopold told us. The buck lies on his mountain, and the golden gravy is the sunshine that floods his days, even unto the end. Wow! This is a poem in the form of a recipe.
I think in a way, Aldo Leopold, he was just as human as anyone, and he was sort of culture-bound and had sort of ethnic tunnel vision, typical of his day. And we see this in one of his most famous essays, The Green Lagoons, which describes a canoe trip that he and his brother took in 1922 in the Colorado Delta, and they extol this wonderful landscape as a milk and honey wilderness. It's a place they don't find any sign of human beings except a very old axe cut. So he talks about this as the true wilderness, and it has no people. But the fact is that the Kokopa Indians, who had been there for centuries, and others before them since time immemorial, were only recently departed because of settlement activities upstream that had diverted too much of the Colorado River water away from the flats of the delta, where the Kokopo relied upon the annual natural growth of a millet-like grass whose seed they subsisted on in part. And so Aldo Leopold was going into this much altered ecosystem thinking it was pure wilderness nature, but in fact it was an altered place where the native inhabitants had had to leave because of the alteration. It's important for two reasons. One is that there's a tradition in American wilderness thinking that somehow the purest land is the land without people in it. But there were people in all the lands. Our wilderness movement really didn't get started until the native people were removed from most of these wilderness areas, and so they became safe for people to go and camp and recreate in and so forth. But the fact is that all these places were occupied. And the second reason is that if we ignore the presence of those people in our thinking about wild lands, we also ignore the wisdom that they can provide us, the wisdom that inheres in their life ways and in their traditions that can give us insight into how we should comport ourselves and what we should do in our relationship with the land.
I think what Leopold was trying to tell us was that a civilization that disconnects itself from the land ultimately pays the price. And he looked historically at civilizations that, that kind of separated themselves. And I think in many ways, America and other industrialized nations are experimenting with a massive and highly risky enterprise. Can we disconnect ourselves from land, from soil and water and grass, and survive? And I think that question is not clear yet, but I think certain signals we're getting that that probably is not a good thing to have done, to kind of pulled away from a bond, a relationship with nature. We get our food from far away. We don't spend much time in nature. If we do, it's quick, recreational in nature. And we're hoping that through technology or through something that we can kind of keep all of this going, where Leopold was constantly reminding folks that when societies do that, they tend to break down at some point, that when we lose that bond, when we lose the land that has nurtured us and supported us, that's not sustainable. And that was his kind of overriding message through the 30s and 40s. It fell largely on deaf ears as industrialism took off and as the goodies that industrialism brought us, you know, cheap food and lots of stuff, kind of came cascading down on us. We said, well, yeah, maybe we can do this. Maybe we can create a food system that just pushes all our food away, the production away. We can play on the land. I'm not so sure that he was wrong. Maybe we need to think about this bond with land. And we're finding out, I think, now that, you know, there are big consequences for having tried this experiment. And I'm desperately hopeful that we can find ways of kind of reconnecting, rebonding ourselves to dirt, to soil, to water, be it through work, through food, through play, through whatever it is that we need to do to get back in touch with the kinds of things that the Native Americans have talked about and other folks in land-based communities have talked about for a long time that we've just kind of taken for granted. And we better not take it for granted for much longer at our own peril.
He was counting geese for his daughter Nina and her husband Bill Elder to see whether geese flew in family flocks, what the size of the flocks was as they came in the evening or flew out in the morning. And he counted more geese in his last counts at the shack that weekend in spring on the 20th or 21st of April, 1948, than he had ever before counted at the shack. And then while he was busy sharpening tools and getting ready to work during the morning, he saw smoke rising across the marsh on his neighbor's property and realized that it was getting worse and that the fire must be getting away from them, that he and Estella and Big Estella, his wife, should go and help to put out that fire. He stationed them along the road. He went walking with a fire pump toward the flames, and that was the last that the family saw of him. He probably had a heart attack and lay down in the grass. Fire passed gently over him, and that was it.
The final essay in Aldo Leopold's A Sand County Almanac is entitled The Land Ethic. To me, this is one of the most important pieces of writing in the English language, and I'd like to share a passage with you. But first, I want to say that for generations, American and Western culture have been dominated by an economic paradigm founded largely on turning habitat into money. Aldo Leopold came to understand the folly and error of that thinking over 60 years ago. He also learned early on that we as a species are but a single part of the community of life on our planet, and that indeed we are rooted in nature. At this point in history, it is imperative that we heed his words in his final essay, and I quote, "A land ethic, then, reflects the existence of an ecological conscience, and this in turn reflects a conviction of individual responsibility for the health of the land. Health is the capacity of the land for self-renewal. Conservation is our effort to understand and preserve this capacity." And he also wrote, "Quit thinking about decent land use as solely an economic paradigm. Examine each question in terms of what is ethically and aesthetically expedient. A thing is right when it tends to preserve the integrity, stability, and beauty of the biotic community. It is wrong when it tends otherwise." Production of Aldo Leopold and the Emerging Land Ethic was made possible by grants from the Aldo Leopold Foundation in Baraboo, Wisconsin, the Christensen Fund of San Francisco, and the New Mexico Humanities Council. Theme music was provided by Carl Bernstein. Our program is a production of The Lore of the Land and was produced in association with KUNM, Community Public Radio in Albuquerque, New Mexico. This is Jack Leffler. Thank you for listening.